Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with the ongoing investigative reporting series, AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of HIV. This is part 10 in the series. In one of our last programs, I described how many people within the scientific community are, for the first time, saying that the test that would determine if you have the so-called HIV and AIDS virus is itself completely flawed and therefore totally unreliable. Because at the heart of the entire argument is, how do you know if you're infected? People are now paranoid about the HIV virus. People are wondering, have any of their former lovers been infected and didn't tell them, possibly didn't know? People are scrambling to get the tests. And with the assurance that if they've tested negative, therefore they have not been in any way contaminated, and therefore needn't worry. But if they do have an HIV positive test, that's very serious. That will mean that they're going to develop AIDS, and in time they will die. The best they can expect is in the interim to take the antiretroviral drugs like AZT and DDI at DDC, the protease inhibitors, and follow their physician's advice, and hopefully they will have a latency period that will give them some opportunity to live. But just the idea that you've tested positive in and of itself is such a stress, chronic stress, debilitating stress, that it can throw your entire immune system out of kilter. So what if the entire AIDS test were totally fraudulent, that there was no basis in science to support it? Hard to imagine? Impossible? Let's examine some of the facts again briefly. I'll give you some new information, and then I'm going to go into what will begin to be the challenge that HIV has even been isolated. Now, up to this point in my discussions, I have presented the orthodox point of view that HIV is real, that hundreds of thousands of scientists are using it in tests to create vaccines, and that, of course, it's there. Easy to identify, easy to find in someone's body. Not even Peter Duisberg has doubted that. But setting aside Duisberg, there are thousands of scientists now who say, show us the virus. Where is it? Here's a person with full-blown AIDS. Take a sample of their blood. Show us where it's at. You mean it's not in the blood? Then how does it get from cell to cell if it's not in the blood? How do you infect cells in one part of the brain and a part of the central nervous system, part of the liver, if it doesn't get there through the either lymphatic system or the blood system? Now, you're saying you can't find it in the blood and you can't find it in the lymph fluids? Where are you finding it? They're asking some very intelligent questions, but is anyone listening? The unreliability of the AIDS test first. Adjunct to the problem of the possible misclassification of sick people due to presumptive diagnosis is the even more startling miscategorization that more occur as being classified false positive, reading from a blood test, than we've ever been led to believe, which is assumed to indicate a person is infected with HIV positive. Whatever the causal role of HIV, the tests now used are not accurate in determining whether a person actually has HIV in their blood. Because, for example, the tests often come up positive in reaction to conditions other than HIV. Public unawareness and the media's unreliability of reporting accurately on the tests in particular is pernicious because of how seriously people take the results. Writing from the orthodox viewpoint, a Dr. Schwab puts it, quote, the awesome consequences and implications of a positive result make it a unique test against all other clinical laboratory tests. Not only is it a confirmation of a terminal illness, but it also categorizes the individuals as a source of lethal transmittable virus who will remain infectious for the rest of their life In addition, affirms a status which will permanently be a severe social and economic hardship for the rest of that person's life, unquote. And mind you, that's from the Orthodox point of view. Unfortunately, these tests are not like pregnancy tests, which are usually correct. This is not widely known, but it can have dire consequences. Let's look first at the question of assessing the distribution and number of AIDS cases. What if we find, for example, and this is not an imaginary case, a man is given the test and comes up positive. He takes another test and, in fact, on every other such test comes up negative. If this frequently happens, as we will certainly show that it does, then many people who are diagnosed as HIV carriers based upon one test and who never take a second test may not actually be positive. Thus, when such a person dies of TB or malaria or hepatitis or cancer, they will not be listed as having died of that disease. They will be listed as dying of AIDS, and as if it had nothing to do with the TB. If such inaccurate diagnoses are widespread, and I believe they are, then here is more evidence that actual existence of AIDS is being overreported. Further, to turn to more emotional rot issues, this inaccuracy level means that many victims of a faulty test erroneously think they are HIV positives. For a person that believes with the establishment that HIV equals AIDS equals death, a false diagnosis will lead to tragedy. Yet you may think of the case I cite in the short AIDS a discussion I will have now before I go on to another issue in AIDS. I bring up the long-running Broadway play Rent. I'm not interested in its theatrical value, such as it is, but in its espousal of popular misconceptions of AIDS. In the play, a woman is diagnosed as HIV positive. She goes home, writes a note to her boyfriend, and kills herself. She doesn't know that most doctors recommend at least two blood tests because of the recognized unreliability of the tests now used. Because of the widespread lack of information around this issue, then, I'll devote some attention as to how these tests operate, in what ways they are seen to be inadequate, and in that, for example, they can't distinguish between HIV and malaria, HIV and herpes, HIV and hepatitis, HIV and the flu, HIV and the common cold, HIV and pregnancy, and about 55 other conditions. What futile attempts have been made by test advocates to make the tests more accurate, and what part these tests have played in stoking irrational fears will also be discussed. First of all, what's being tested? You thought it was an AIDS virus. Wrong. If I ask the average man or woman on the street, I'll designate this person Dr. Well informed what the HIV blood test does. He will tell you it checks for HIV in your blood. How does it do that? I would ask. Well, Mr. Well informed would answer, it looks in there to see if there are any viral particles. Well, what good is knowing that? Well, he says, if you're HIV positive, you'll get AIDS. In point of fact, none of this is true. Total nonsense, absolute fabrication, complete fraud, the worst heresy imaginable. But that's the entire base of the AIDS Orthodox scientific point of view. How tragic. How many of those who are checking their blood via tests read the materials accompanying it? Let me actually read you what's on the insert. It might be rather interesting. One ELISA test has a leaflet that explains, quote, the test for the existence of antibodies against AIDS-associated virus is not diagnosis for AIDS and AIDS-like diseases. Positive test results do not prove that someone has an AIDS or pre-AIDS disease status, nor that it will acquire it. Unquote. Now, we've already argued that HIV infection does not necessarily lead to AIDS, as the leaflet states, but look at the first line closely. Quote, the test is for antibodies, entities created by the body to battle against viral infection, not for HIV itself. Unquote. Well, well-informed might ask, why don't they just test for the retrovirus itself? Such a question would be overlooking the unfortunate fact that, according to Dr. Stefan Lanka, one of the world's leading virologists, there are, quote, photographs of virus-like particles in cell cultures, but they are none of isolated viruses, let alone the structure within the human body having the shape described HIV, unquote. There are no photographs of HIV ever created, period. Now, any of the scientists, physicians in this audience, you think, I got Gary there. Got him. Okay? Do you? You think you're that smart? Go to the library. Find in any medical book, any textbook, any magazine. Go to Nature, Science. Go to any virology publication. Surely they would have hundreds of photographs by now of this virus. Then contact the magazine editor and ask them this question. Is this the actual photograph or is this a photo rendition? Oh, there's a difference. Big difference. A friend of mine is probably going to be nominated for an Academy Award this year for a movie he was cinematographer on. And in a conversation we had just last couple weeks ago, he said they had to put into the budget an enormous amount of extra money for digitally recorrecting the drooping eyelid on one of the stars, correcting a nose bump on another. And I said, well, that's awful expensive. Then every single shot you have to then stop it frame by frame and digitally correct. He said, yes, but that's what the stars want. They can take 30 pounds off your weight. They can do anything. Well, what if you just took any virus and then you made it look like what you thought an HIV virus should look like? In point of fact, that's what happened in London when the photograph of the so-called AIDS virus was shown in the leading magazine there. The archives were contacted and they admitted it was a rendition. But it didn't say rendition under the caption, clearly giving one the impression this was a photograph. Even if such a photograph did exist, how would you know it was HIV? Couldn't tell. Because of all the debris and other viruses. Well, since this is not available, this photo, the second best we have would be look back at the blood test, the ELISA test, which are the most commonly used. Find in that ELISA test an antibody that is conjectured would only be produced if HIV were present. The logic is, of course, that the antibody, whose whole purpose is to eliminate the virus it fights against, was not successful. If it were, it would only indicate that the patient had been HIV infected, but the antibody had destroyed the infection. The assumption is the antibody was created, but was not successful in eliminating the virus. The possible flawed character of this set of assumptions has not escaped the critics. Dr. Duisberg nails the point home. Quote, antibodies, he says, quote, are always indications of immunity, not disease. Why then are HIV positive results interpreted to mean that full-blown AIDS is imminent? Unquote. Let's pursue his reasoning a little further, though it has to be taken with a grain of salt. Duisberg's underlined how HIV is the one virus that seems to be the most successful virus ever after antibodies have waged war on it. He continues, he said, quote, there is no microbe anywhere in microbiology that causes disease only after it is neutralized by antibodies. That is the very reason why vaccinations work so well, unquote. In a vaccine, one receives a mild dose of the disease, which creates antibodies. Then when the person comes in contact with full-blown versions of the disease, the body does not have to produce antibodies, but it already has them there because it's been forearmed. With most viruses, the antibody's presence indicates the virus is being ushered out, with one exception. When you have made antibodies to HIV, then all of a sudden everyone tells you, now, my friend, you're in trouble, unquote. Duisberg is being excessive here, since, as I've already explained, viruses like genital herpes do survive an initial rebuff by antibodies hiding out in nerve cells. Although, like most viruses that temporarily retreat, subsequent attacks of the herpes are measurably less virulent than the original onslaught. In fact, an early orthodox hypothesis, since shelved, about AIDS latency period saw it as following a herpes-like strategy. Barry Schaub, director of the National Institutes of Virology in Johannesburg, and a scourge of the dissidents argued this point in 1994. A person would be infected by two strains of HIV, he said, one fast-acting and obvious, the other slow-replicating, which made it harder for the body's immune system to recognize. And stealthily, hiding in blood cells where it replicated without harming its host, so that it was left in peace by the policing of the immune system. When HIV enters, he wrote, the more virulent variants probably undergo several cycles of replication but are overcome by an intact functioning immune system. Thus, the presence of numerous antibodies at this stage indicates that, yes, a bodily counterattack against the virus had been successful, but no, this is not a positive result since the second strain of the virus is hiding out and working on a sapping strategy. Of course, this is all hypothetical because none of it has ever been proven. You have everyone's got a theory. Where's the proof? Where's the evidence? Dr. Stefan Lanka challenges all this. He says, quote, this is routinely done by layering proteins ostensibly from the virus in the walls of a plastic rack and adding blood serum to be tested each. If antibodies are present, they bind to the proteins, and when this happens, sophisticated staining procedures can make this visible. To be more specific, the viral proteins are from HIV antigens. Antigens are markers that appear on the outside of all cells. Each type of cell has specific markers, which in the human body, for example, makes it possible for circulating cells, like those of blood, to identify and be identified by it for exchange of material or information. Viral particles also have these outer markings. After studying this description, the quick-witted reader or listener will come back, hey, if HIV has never been isolated, how do scientists figure out what proteins are in HIV antigens? Unquote. Ah, there's the rub. However, before looking into that, we should finish describing how the ELISA works. The HIV proteins are taken, according to the orthodox view, from viruses, or more often, parts of viruses that have been cultured in a laboratory. Certain proteins tend to be characteristic of retroviruses, and it is conjectured these proteins are from a retrovirus. Traditionally, to obtain viral particles, the cell in which they have been growing have to be burst open. After opening up the cells, a messy mixture remains, made up of the viruses and the unwanted debris of the host cells. Presumably, scavenging through that, the scientists find the desired antigenic proteins. These proteins were first used as is, and then, with the creation of a second generation of tests, were created through further processes using genetic engineering. The Western blot test utilizes a similar connection between HIV antigen and antibody, but it is more finely calibrated. Individual proteins from the HIV antigen are put on bands on nitrocellulose paper. The alluded to controversy in interpreting of these tests hinges on how many proteins a patient must have to be called HIV positive, since any single one of the proteins on the paper taken by itself could be derived from a source other than HIV. On the lighter side, I might mention that the curious way this test got its name, Dr. Edward Southern developed a blot test for DNA identification and named it after himself. A similar test for RNA was waggishly called the Northern blot, and the Western blot follows by taking the next available point on the compass. Now, to get back to the crux of the difficulties of this test modus operandi, we need to examine both the broader question of whether a method would ever be practical which sought to work with the antibody of a virus that had never been isolated, and the narrow one of whether Gallo's attempt to finesse this seemingly impossibility and obtain these antibodies was a valid one. Dr. Val Turner, a critic of the HIV establishment and one of the key members of the Perth group that I'll get to on another program, unless time permits today, where I will give their point of view that HIV has never been isolated, does not exist, and they will go into great detail about what is actually being measured and why, hence, the entire effort on the war on AIDS is misdirected. He broaches the broader question via analogy. To understand his comparison, we need to merely touch on several points about particle isolation that we will study more fully later. Isolation as the word implies, has traditionally meant separating the virus from everything else so that, for example, one has obtained in a solution a band of pure HIV. But this has never been done for the retrovirus. Rather, HIV or segments of it have been identified within a heterogeneous living culture where it is has appeared with other entities. The same can be said for the HIV antibody, which has also never been isolated. Now, it may sound a little confusing. I'll try to keep summarizing it in lay language. But imagine this experiment. Someone hands you a test tube containing milks obtained from a half dozen different animals. In other words, a mixture of several different proteins, but you don't know how, from which animals. Now, in place of a mixture of antibodies from AIDS patients, you obtain a second test tube containing a number of different acids. You add the mixture of acids to the mixture of milks and produce curdles. Now you claim you've isolated the proteins of a cow or a goat. And not just any cow or goat, a completely new species of cow or goat, one never seen before. So to translate the analogy back to real situations, AIDS is accompanied by antibodies, ones never before identified, so we don't know virus or microorganism they were created to fight against, which are interpreted as proof of that AIDS-diagnosed patients are infected with HIV. Then the antibodies are used to prove that HIV is a cause of AIDS. In other words, AIDS proves it's HIV, proves it's AIDS. Sounds strange? It is. Sounds like it's just bad science, intolerably bad science. To take the leading point from this somewhat baroque analogy, if one has never isolated HIV in the first place, how can you claim that antibodies found in blood are ones attuned to that retrovirus? It's a rather flawed logic that would hold one. One can prove the existence of one unidentified entity by its correlation with another identified one, like proving goblins exist because ghosts say they do. Dr. Paul Philpott broaches a second defective assumption underlying these tests. Assuming for the sake of argument that one had found an antibody that will identify HIV, one must also assume the, quote, proteins are to be exclusive to HIV and the antibodies that react with them must react with no other proteins, unquote. As I've explained, in the test antibodies are to bind with proteins on the wall of a plastic rack. For this test to be valid, the proteins must be ones found only in HIV. We also know, in discussing the Western blot, that such proteins may not be exclusive to HIV. Why else would there be a controversy over how many need to be present for HIV to be indicated? Dr. Philpott adds that Dr. Papadopoulos Eliopoulos has studied all the proteins used in the test to bind the antibodies and given a list of cellular proteins from which these proteins may have been derived as readily as they might have from HIV. She has also drawn up, quote, a list of non-HIV entities that cause reactions with HIV antibody tests and absolutely falsified the specific antibody ideal for HIV, unquote. But if these antibodies are so suspiciously cross-reactive, meaning they'll react with a flu, you go out and get a flu shot, then go get a HIV antibody shot, high probability you're going to test positive. Now, what's going to happen when the doctor says, you've got AIDS? And you say, but doctor, how can I have AIDS? I've never done anything. Well, no one else has either, but you've got AIDS. You mean we're all equally susceptible to AIDS? That's right. Haven't you looked at the ads on television? No one's immune? But doc, if that's the case, why is it I just see fast-track gays, people with intravenous drug users and some hemophiliacs who've got AIDS and the rest of the population don't? Including sexually promiscuous people, including people who, teenagers. How about this? Try this on, doc. Who are the most sexually promiscuous people in the United States who have more sex than any other human being ever? Porno stars. Someone actually took the time. This is one of those things that's so obvious, it's kind of embarrassing, no one's thought of it. To do a complete check of the sexual history of all the leading porno stars for the last 20 years. And they found that of all the leading porno stars, not one woman has ever had AIDS, and only one claimed that she was sick, but it was never shown that that she had AIDS. All those other women who had sex tens of thousands of times, unprotected, no AIDS, no HIV, no sicknesses. And yet, on occasion, they came down with some sexually transmitted diseases, which they took antibiotics for and were cured from. And what about all the male porno stars? Again, with the exception of John Holmes, who didn't die of AIDS, he died of, he was a IV drug user, and also he was bisexual, and he was taking antiretrovirals, including AZT. And many of us believe that you can die just from AZT if you're totally healthy. But what about all the other male porno stars? Hundreds of them. No one got AIDS. Now you'd think that if you took all the male and female porno stars and you put them together and you would say, what would be the statistical likelihood of this group of 100 individuals who've had sex over 1 million times? Some of these people have had sex over, you ready for this? Over 20,000 times. Then surely they would be the highest at risk in the world. And it turns out they're not. Well, doesn't that just throw a little curve in the logic of so much of this? In any case, so here you go in and you get a, you say, Doc, I have arthritis. Well, that has nothing to do with AIDS. Oh, no, no, there's a peer-reviewed journal here that says that it will test react positive with the antibodies to HIV. Well, I didn't read it. Well, Doc, have you read every issue of the New England Journal of Medicine? No. Have you remembered every article you read when you did read it? No. Well, there are 8,000 peer-reviewed publications that come out every year in mainstream journals, another 100,000 in scholarly but less well-read ones but are still peer-reviewed. So one clinician's ignorance of the fact of cross-reactivity to the measles, herpes, you've got 45 to 55 million Americans suffer from herpes. That means that anyone who has herpes who gets an HIV antibody test could test positive and be told they have AIDS and then forced in some communities then to have your name go on a government register. Later on in another program, I'll deal with the new medical ID card that I warned you all about 4 years ago that now they're trying to push through as law that every American would have a medical ID card. Needless to say, anyone who tests positive for HIV, that's going to be a big mark against you, and everybody then would know. Anyhow, this is some of the problems that we're seeing, that these antibodies are non-specific. So therefore, the test is non-specific. And because they haven't isolated the virus, and it's the only condition I'm aware of where you can die from not having the virus present. I mean, if you have hepatitis and you die, you find the hepatitis in big numbers there. But not with this. And time and again, when they've done large studies on large group of people, including service people, they find out that that a first test was never verified, and when it was found that it was false. Because there is no gold standard. Now, let's ask one more question. Dr. Eliopoulos, who's one of the most brilliant women in medicine today in the world, outstanding mind. When I interviewed her, she said, quote, one cannot simultaneously use the presence of AIDS as proof of HIV infection and conversely the presence of a positive HIV test as proof that HIV is the cause of AIDS, as presently is the case. That is, anybody with AIDS who tests positive for HIV confirms that HIV caused the disease. Anyone with AIDS who tests negative was a false negative, i.e. the test wasn't done right. This is a type of science that is very convenient for producing any kind of result you might want, though its relation to the truth does not seem harmonious. Let's take on another issue here. I'd like to go into, by the way, for those of you who just joined us, I'm Gary Nall, talking about a challenge to AIDS, offering people who have not heard that there is a challenge to it, realizing there are over 3,000 leading dissident scientists, physicians, activist journalists who say we have to reevaluate everything we've been taught about AIDS because virtually everything we've been taught is wrong. This is part 10 of our series. It's tape number 2662. Later on at the end of the show, if you'd like to get a copy of today's tape, you can call 888-317-2346. As for program number 2662. Before looking at some of the criticism these findings have elicited, let's recall what we said earlier about scientific work and of what I mentioned on my lash about the philosopher Popper's idea of testing a theorem. When we find that a number of other scientists have gone at Montagnier and Gallo's findings hammer and tongs, we should not take this as evidence of a cranky disposition on the part of the questioners. No, such criticism is paramount to the development of intelligent scientific theorems, which ideally will prove themselves unshakable in the face of rigorous critique. Nor should we follow the gullible media in thinking that publication in a prestigious journal like Science represents a blanket endorsement by the editors of what the authors published. Acceptance by the journal connotes only that the research is credible and deserving of further review, which will either fortify or puncture the positions laid out by the published authors. Further, to be fair, some of the points raised by the scientists who claim to have discovered HIV would look worse in the light of developing knowledge about retroviruses than they did according to the wisdom at the time. Let's turn to the criticisms, bringing in for convenience here also complaints against Gallo when these complaints were aimed at the same type of claims made by the Pasteur Institute. I'll go through some and I'll explain them. What's called budding. To start, we'll take up one of the less significant items in Montagnier and his colleagues' argument, the subclaim of claim one that in the T-cell sample were observed cells that were budding in a way indicative of retroviruses. Or reverse transcriptase. Montagnier and his colleagues wrote back in 1984, quote, several characteristics indicate LAV or LAV-related viruses belong to the retrovirus family. Budding particles at the plasma membrane have been observed in electron microscopes, unquote. However, according to Dr. Eliopoulos, Montagnier has admitted, quote, we published images of budding which are characteristic of retroviruses. Having said that, on morphology alone, one could not say that it was truly a retrovirus. Let me repeat that. Characteristic of retroviruses. Not the same as having said this is a proven, acceptable, identifiable retrovirus. With the first budding pictures, it could be a type C virus. Thus, if one went with the photographs alone, positive identification of the particles as retroviruses were impossible, since the budding could be evidence of a more typically found DNA virus. Number two, reverse transcriptase. Basic claim was that in the T-cell cultures of the man infected with the syndrome, reverse transcriptase, which it was believed cannot be carried on by T cells themselves, was observed. It was conjectured that this reverse transcriptase signaled the presence of retrovirus. However, this is a disquieting problem with this conclusion. Given that banding had not been carried out and these retrovirus particles were located in a mixed culture, how were the scientists so dead sure that retrovirus or reverse transcriptase activity was due to a retrovirus? It is possible anything other than a virus might be causing it. Indeed, it is. This is the question of specification. It has been shown that, quote, not all particles with reverse transcriptase activity and visual properties of that seeming resembling retroviruses are viruses, unquote. Heliopoulos asserts further, quote, this is a fact acknowledged even by Gallo well before the AIDS era, quote. She elaborates, reverse transcriptase is not truly specific of retroviruses. Non-infected cells, as well as bacteria or viruses other than retroviruses, have reverse transcriptase. According to some of the best-known retrovirologists, including its discoverers, as well as Nobel laureates and director of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, Harold Varmus, reverse transcriptases are present in all cells, including bacteria. Indeed, reverse transcriptase activity has been reported in many cell lines from which HIV is isolated. The important nuance in her eyes is that some scientists are not carefully distinguishing between characteristic of and exclusive to. I agree. That reverse transcriptase activity is characteristic of retroviruses. However, specificity does not have the same meaning as characteristic. Hair is characteristic of human beings, but not every animal has hair that is human. She sums up, quote, it is true that Montagnier and his associates reported reverse transcriptase activity at the density of 1.11 g millimeters, but since, quote, Montagnier's collaborator in his first isolation of HIV and Cherman accept that cells and cellular fragments also have reverse transcriptase activity at the 1.11 g millimeter band, no particles with the morphological characteristics of retroviruses were seen. It follows that the evidence for the existence of HIV by detecting reverse transcriptase activity at that density was not only not specific, but non-existent. Unquote. She's saying, fellas, you never isolated it. Also, let's take a look at another argument. Killing of T cells. One typical pattern of virus operation is as follows. The virus is inoperatively floating through your bloodstream. It hooks on to a compatible cell, and the DNA and RNA inside the viral envelope is injected into the cell. This matter travels to the cell's nucleus, where it commanders the host machinery and begins manufacturing more viruses. These viruses fill up the cell to the point it is ruptured and dies. The new viruses now float through the blood looking for new victims. Imagining this process by taking place, Montagnier and colleagues noticed a decrease of T cells in their sample, which they believe could be attributed to the ruthless activity of the AIDS virus. They counted the number of T cells in this manner. Quote, the number of T4 and CD4 cells in the culture were measured by counting the number of cells able to bind to a monoclonal antibody claimed specific for the CD4 protein, unquote. The plainer language and lay language, the scientists were not tallying numbers of T cells directly, but the number of T cell antibody dyads, imagining that any existing T cells would naturally bind with these antibodies. But this is no foolproof method. Quote, at the beginning of the AIDS era, there was ample evidence that treatment of cell cultures with PHA and other oxidizing agents leads to a decreasing binding of CD4 cells, unquote. In other words, it is possible the same number of T cells were in the culture, but they were no longer binding to the antibody because their exposure to agents used in preparing the culture. Quote, in this type of culture, T cells lose their CD4 marker and acquire other markers, including CD8, while the total number of T cells remain constant, unquote. Heliopoulos remarks acidly, quote, it is surprising that Montagnier and his colleagues did not have controls, that is, cultures of T4 cells originating from patients who were not at risk of AIDS, but who nonetheless were sick, and to which they added PHA and IL-2, interleukin-2. Unquote. If such controls were used, it would have been determined if the seeming disappearance of T cells was due to the effect of the preparation or to their being destroyed by some retrovirus, since the healthy T cells in the control would seem to disappear as they suffered the effect of preparation. To recap, we see Montagnier's group claim to have identified a retrovirus could be assailed in a number of ways, especially in that reverse transcriptase budding and activity were not exclusive to retroviruses, and that it is not definitively known whether T cells were being killed or merely having their detectability altered by the culture's preparation. Now, let me digress for 1 second here. at this very time that Montagnier and Gallo and Exeter and Anthony Fauci were claiming that you've got to measure the T cells, just having a low T. First it was 500 T cells, then it was 300, then it was 200. In other words, if you just had lower than 200 T cells, you were presumptive diagnostic of AIDS. I said this makes no sense, because I had seen so many cancer patients who, when I would be looking at their blood workups, had very low T cell counts. So I did a study. I did a study with a lot of people. I took a number of completely healthy lifestyle people, meaning they were vegetarians, didn't drink, had no record, no history of intravenous drug use. Many of them were gay, but they were not fast-track gay. And I took them from what would be presumed to be the at-risk age groups. And we took T-cells. And I remember at the time, we saw, depending upon the level of stress the person was under and any psychological crisis occurring in their lives, loss of a job, loss of a relationship, overwork, overexercise. In fact, one subgroup of these people were marathon runners, and they had very low T cells. I remember some of them coming in with under 100 T cells. None of them developed opportunistic infections. None of them were sick. And yet, had these people gone in to get a HIV antibody test and also had a presumptive diagnosis just based upon a low T cell, they might have found themselves with a doctor suggesting AZT immediately. That then could have killed them. Now, when we took a subgroup of these people who had been diagnosed full-blown AIDS, I took six of them initially, and I put them on a very specific detoxification, cleansing, rebuilding protocol. In fact, my 7 Steps to Perfect Health, that's the protocol I put them on, except it was a little more vigorous because they had some intravenous vitamin therapies and some ozone therapies. It took 16 months, and the people tested negative across the board on all their tests. They had had herpes, hepatitis, mycoplasms, Epstein-Barr, herpes 6, gone. Totally gone out of their system. What was of interest was that their T-cells stayed very low. In fact, to this day, one of them, who I keep in regular contact with and have monitored now for over 10 years, he is a model of health. He's married, has a family, his kids, and all of his children he's had since he was diagnosed as full-blown AIDS are totally healthy. All their bloods are completely normal. But his T-cells, 8. Not 800, 8. So there was a time when if you had a T-cell under 100, you were considered in the last stages before you died. And people would say, oh, they have under 10 T cells. They've got a week to live, 2 weeks to live. It was all wrong. Absolutely wrong. So what I'm saying is that them simply suggesting, as Eliopoulos has suggested, a low T cell count cannot be indicative of an antibody react or to a viral action against the body of HIV. It can be due to many different things. Now, Dr. Eleni Papadopoulos, Eliopoulos, and her group in Perth have centered their work on unraveling some of the flaws and fallacies surrounding the HIV blood test and in studying the claims of for the existence of a retrovirus in the blood of pre-AIDS patients. When Neville Hodgkinson, the journalist I met with earlier this year, interviewed for a documentary I'm doing, which will be out in about 6 months, she recalled how unfriendly scientific critic circles were to the original retroviral hypothesis of the French team. She said, quote, Nature turned down the Montagnier's team's paper that was later held to have been the first to demonstrate the presence of HIV, unquote. It was felt at that point that it was unlikely that AIDS was caused by retrovirus. Later, one of these papers was published in Science, where you may recall Dr. Gallo was one of the reviewers. When this was mentioned earlier, it was only to bring up how he threw in an unsolicited comment about his own research. What was not mentioned then was that, though he later relied on their findings, at the time he thought the French discovery of the retrovirus was bogus. In fact, quite ironically, he brought up some of the same complaints against the French that are now being turned against him. Quote, "No one has ever been able to work with their particles," unquote. Gallo wrote The Lancet, taking the French to task. He went on, quote, "Because of the lack of permanent production and characterization, it is hard to say the retroviruses they detected, are really isolated in the sense that virologists used this term," unquote. Mind you, this is Robert Gallo saying this. Moreover, he had doubts that the microscopic pictures accompanying the Science piece were genuinely of a human retrovirus. Eventually, as we know, Gallo turned a corner on this, like a sinner who has resisted the evangelist, but then goes through an overnight conversion. Gallo followed a similar path in viewing the French retrovirus, suddenly made an about-face. According to Eliopoulos, this turnabout could be put down to the pressure he was under, she feels, with the National Cancer Institute suddenly coming under acute pressure from the Reagan administration to do something about AIDS. Gallo seems to have allowed his competitiveness to overcome his judgment, leaping on the bandwagon of the French AIDS virus by naming it HTLV-3 once it appeared to have get the ball rolling. She believes Gallo entered, quote, what he later called the passionate stage, forcefully arguing for the existence of an AIDS-causing virus. When his own candidate as the AIDS virus, HTLV-1, proved a non-starter with the scientific community, unquote. To tell a little more of the back story, though, remember, the Gallo was constrained to switch his allegiance to the French virus because the first candidate for AIDS-causing retrovirus, Gallo identified HTLV-1, the one he tried to foist on Montagnier in his abstract for their papers, did not hold up. Montagnier's team said it was not the same retrovirus that they had found. Meanwhile, in further trials, Gallo himself was not finding it with regularity. That's why he eventually traded in his virus for one found by the Pasteur Institute. Now, some of the same objections might be raised to Gallo's isolation of his virus as were brought up against that done by Montagnier's group, such as questions about the equation of reverse transcriptase activity with the presence of retroviruses. However, let's cover two other topics about the research leading up to his 1984 Science paper in which he tentatively claimed HIV was responsible for AIDS. A, the antibodies used to identify HIV, and B, the percentages of cases of HIV infection among the patients whose blood were studied. First, the HIV antibody issue. We saw the importance of antibodies when we observed how the Pasteur Institute used antibodies to T cells to count the number of T cells in a culture. In Gallo's work, antibodies to HIV were used to determine whether a specific blood sample had traces of the retrovirus. He obtained the antibodies by first infecting rabbits with HIV, with AIDS, supposedly, and then drawing out the antibodies they produced. Aside from the dubiousness of expecting the processes in rabbit and in human blood to run parallel, which I do not believe they do, and just one more reason to support anti-vivisection, there is a peculiar circulatory lack of logic here. His procedures seem plagued with a circularity, as was brought out in the interview I did with Christine Johnson, and the Perth doctor also stated, quote, "Gallo claims he had a serum from rabbits that contained antibodies specific to HIV. Now, just imagine for a moment the scene in Gallo's laboratory. They've cultured H9 cells, and when they came to determine which proteins in their culture originate from the presumed virus, they reach up on the shelf, and lo and behold, they pull down a bottle labeled specific antibodies to HIV. How did they manage to get those antibodies? This was the first paper they wrote about that they already had a bottle containing rabbit antibodies specific to a virus they were currently attempting to isolate for the very first time. They say they have prepared rabbit antibodies by repeatedly infecting rabbits with HIV. But if they were preparing antibodies to HIV, they would have had to inject rabbits with pure HIV, which again means they must already have isolated what they were now attempting to do for the first time. It doesn't make sense. To even begin to talk about specific antibodies to specific HIV proteins, first you must have to prove the particles are constituents of a retroviral-like particle that is able to replicate. And the only way to do that is to isolate the particles and do everything else I've described. You need the virus before you go looking for proteins and antibodies. They hadn't discovered the virus. Therefore, how did they get the antibodies if they never had the virus to inject into the rabbits? Where is the scientific curiosity? Where is the people suddenly going, heads up? How can you have antibodies specific to a virus that you've never isolated? To get the antibodies, you first have to have the virus to create the antibodies. It's the virus that creates the antibodies, not the antibodies that creates a virus. The questionable method used here, since the details of how Gallo obtained the HIV to give to the rabbits were never published, is that they took banded specimens of proteins that were said to be viral particles. These would then be the type of particles Montagnier claimed were evidence of a retrovirus, such as those that showed budding. The same weaknesses we saw in his claim for these particles were necessarily that of a retrovirus could then be appended to Gallo's research. That's one argument. Second argument, the number of cases of HIV presence in AIDS patients. Another weakness in the argument of the 1984 Science paper, which purported to have found the HIV retrovirus, was how infrequently HIV was present in the studied AIDS patients who were supposedly made sick by this virus. Now, Eliopoulos states, quote, Gallo only managed to isolate it from 26 out of 72 AIDS patients. That's only 36%. Only 80% of 49 AIDS patients had antibodies. If the virus was present in only 36 of the patients, why did 88 have antibodies? I mean, there were more patients with antibodies without a virus than there were patients with a virus. Doesn't make sense, does it? The sticking point in all this, all these caveats, both about Montagnier and Gallo's process of pinpointing HIV, are small potatoes compared to the central difficulty. The accepted practice of retroviral isolation was not carried out. Other objections about the attempts to nail down HIV, such as the questions about the presence of reverse transcriptase, pale in insignificance compared to the point that viral isolation was never completed. HIV was located among the debris in a cell culture rather than in a purified band. Let me clarify this. A culture contains a myriad of things and thus by definition is not evidence of isolation of an object. The only way possible to claim that one had made a culture of a virus is to have had proof for the existence of the virus before making a culture. For example, observing something in the ocean which looks like a fish is not equivalent to having the fish in your fry pan separate from everything else that occurs in the ocean. Let's dwell on this. The French and American teams both stopped short before centrifuging blood and carrying out the accepted procedures of viral isolation. Instead, they work with objects in non-purified cell cultures. We saw that according to standard operating procedures, since a homogeneous sample of particles has never been obtained, it was requisite that the scientists engage in further first step isolation procedures, paring down what was in their sample till they ended up with a single type of particle in a band. Then they would be assured that they were studying a single entity before moving into further steps to determine if this entity were new retroviruses. This was never done. Nope. And I will look at the possible reasons for this in a later discussion. In both labs, later steps in the isolation process were taken without this crucial one having been completed. It could be imagined the scientists harped so loudly on the initial factors, such as the presence of reverse transcriptase, because they were subconsciously possibly covering up for the absence of the decisive proof. Their so-called isolation of HIV amounted to the replacement of orthodoxy with a new, less rigorous, more error-prone way of finding viruses. Dr. Eliopoulos put it quite badly. There's a quote, there's an old, logical, reliable, common-sense method of proving the existence of a retrovirus. It's based upon nothing more than the definition of a retrovirus as a particle having a particle size, shape, appearance, and constituents, and the ability to replicate. But for some unknown reason, this method has been abandoned in the HIV era. Don't ask me why, but it has. In its place, we have a disparate collection of data, including particles not photographed in density gradients and some evidence of reverse transcription. Neither of these are proof that a retrovirus exists in these cultures. In an interview with Hugh Christie, Dr. Val Kilmer has echoed on these points by insisting that all the secondary points Gallo has brought forward as evidence of his having isolated HIV from the presence of reverse transcriptase to the resemblance of certain particles and other retroviruses do not add up to the true isolation. As he points out, quote, the only scientific proof that a particle is a virus is purification and analysis followed by experiments to prove particles make more particles exactly the same, unquote. That has never happened in HIV research. Dr. Eliopoulos brings out the ad hoc procedure for isolating retroviruses that the French and the Americans have scared up and used in place of accepted methods. In another place, she drives home the fact that customary usage has not been followed. For isolation of retroviruses, the stage of purification is obligatory. One cannot isolate retroviruses without purifying. By definition, isolation means, quote, to place apart or alone. That's the concise Oxford Dictionary. And purify means, quote, to clear of foreign elements. That's a concise Oxford Dictionary definition. Thus, unless the contaminants are removed from around the HIV particles are not isolated. The lack of isolation throws the whole...